Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of My Old Kentucky Podcast. My name is Robert Connie, and joining me, as always, is Jasmine Smith. Jasmine, how are you today?
Doing well, Robert. Enjoying the fall weather this week.
It is. Fall has finally fallen.
Yeah.
It is. It is cool outside. The leaves are starting to turn. I'm starting to get stressed out about my yard. It is that time of year.
Our birthdays are coming up.
That's true. But yes, today on the show, we have two big topics to talk about. First of all, Confederate statues in Lexington have come down, and we are going to talk a little bit about how that happened and all the folks that made that possible. And also, there is a pension set of bullet points, a pension document framework that exists and is a thing. So we're going to be talking about that.
So we bullet pointed the bullet points.
Basically. We copied the bullet points into our bullet points and are going to talk about them. So that's what we're talking about today. So without any further ado, Jasmine, tell us about Cheapside.
Okay. I called this segment Took Back Cheapside because that's what's happened.
It's a very nice wordplay.
So back in August, the Lexington City Council unanimously voted to move two Confederate statues. We talked about this on the show. There are statues in downtown Lexington of John C. Breckinridge and John Hunt Morgan, two Confederates that were located in the Cheapside Pavilion area of downtown Lexington. So a group called Take Back Cheapside had been advocating for the removal of these statues for the last 2 years. They formed back in 2015 and have been working to do that for 2 years now. So the Cheapside area, and we talked about this before, it was known as being a slave auction block in Lexington, and thousands of slaves were sold there. So
it was like you have these
two,
injury,
right? You have these two Confederates in that area where thousands of slaves were sold.
Right. And the city voted to take them down, but they couldn't, right? That was like something standing in their way.
Yes. After the council unanimously voted, then a month later in September, the Lexington Cemetery Board, where they were going to hopefully move them, voted to accept the statues. But like we talked about and what you said, Robert, there's a state law that requires for removal petitions to go to a state military monuments commission. But last week, to much surprise, police blocked off the area where the Breckinridge statue stood, and city workers began lifting John Breckinridge from his spot in Cheapside and wrapped him up in a tarp. And then the next morning, they began to move John Hunt Morgan from his spot as well.
So it's just kind of like out of nowhere, all of a sudden police blocked
it off. Yeah, and everybody, they blocked traffic a little bit, and everybody's like, what's going on? And so some people came down to downtown to cheer on the removal. It came out of nowhere for all of us, but it seems like the city of Lexington kind of had a plan for this.
Right.
They sought an attorney general opinion, and we've talked about those a lot on the show. We talk about a lot of attorney general opinions, but they wanted to determine whether the Military Monuments Commission had jurisdiction or if this was a decision that they could make as a local authority.
Right.
So Bashir's opinion stated that the Monuments Commission did not have jurisdiction because the mayor who authorized for the commission to have jurisdiction did not have approval from the urban city council to do so, so that action was void.
So what happened was that we thought that this was a state law that was like making it so that the city's decision to remove the statues wasn't valid. But it turns out that that state law had authority over Lexington because a mayor in the past just like said they did.
Over the certain statues.
Right, exactly.
It was an application that was signed by Mayor Teresa Isaacs back in 2003, but she didn't receive approval from the council when that happened, and so that was void, and the AG opinion said this is up to local authorities. The commission doesn't have jurisdiction.
Yeah, so she didn't get the council to vote on it. Like, if she had done that, it probably would have had authority, but she didn't, so the attorney general said, no, this doesn't count.
Correct.
Okay.
And when they received that opinion, they began removal almost immediately. Right now, I don't think we know whether the commission is going to challenge the opinion. The city mailed a copy to the commission, so they have, you know, noticed that that opinion has been rendered, but I don't believe the commission has made any kind of statement or anything like that at this point. And right now, the statues are currently being stored at a private facility until details regarding their placement at the Lexington Cemetery, where both Breckinridge and John Hunt Morgan were buried, are finalized. So right now they're hanging out in a private facility.
This is not, like, the sneak attack to remove the statues isn't totally unique to Lexington. This is something that's happened across, I mean, I remember Baltimore.
Right.
They just showed up one day and all the statues were gone in the middle of the night. And, I mean, there seems like there's several different types of strategies. Like, New Orleans went with, like, the middle of the night strategy where they, like, said we're going to move them on these days in the middle of the night. And they had, like, all this heavy police presence or whatever. But, yeah, Lexington went with a sneak attack.
Right. And I think that people that oppose removing or moving statues would say, like, Lexington just did this out of nowhere all of a sudden. But really, they went through the whole process.
Right.
First, they had a city council vote. Then they made sure that the cemetery would accept the statues. Then they sought an attorney general opinion. They received that opinion and then went forward with removal.
Yeah, no, nobody. I mean, people can kind of, I guess they can say that, and it kind of maybe feels that way because they didn't, like, tell you what day or what time, and
right,
it still
like,
felt kind of up in the air.
To know that.
But yeah, there's, like, the big argument that many people have made is that this should be a local jurisdiction that makes this decision about what goes inside of their borders. I mean, it's a local control issue. It is maybe the one time where, like, local control actually won out that's been, like, a big issue.
I know, yeah, right? So. The city said that removal and relocation of the statues is being paid for from private funds and donations, so that's also good. It doesn't sound like this is costing the city a lot of money or anything, which I'm sure would be some people's criticism of, you know, actions like this. And Mayor Gray believes, he made a statement about the removal basically saying that he believes that a lot of voices on both sides were heard, that the right move was made, and that they handled this the right way. He said, at the end of the day, we did what's right for the real history of Cheapside. And he said that we've shown the way really for the country in how to do this. We engaged the community in a conversation, and that conversation went on for 2 years. And so it was very meaningful. And we heard the sides. We feel like we went about this the right way, he's basically saying.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the argument that I've heard most often from people who support having statues stay where they are is mostly like, it's a historical issue and we're going to forget our history or whatever. Like, have you heard people say that before?
Exactly. I believe that's what our governor said, that we were trying to erase.
That's right.
He used sanitize history, well, is what he said.
And they're moving these statues to a cemetery where these guys are buried. And I think that that's probably a better place for them to be memorialized.
Right.
Yeah. Like, everybody lives and dies. Like, not everybody gets to be on in a prominent place of your city. And, like, moving Confederates away from that is, but into a place where, you know, the statues can, you know, be recognized as these were these people. I think that that's a way to kind of, like, come to the middle. I mean, I think that there's a lot of people who say, you know, we should take down these statues and throw them in the river. I heard that argument from Ricky
Jones.
Yeah, Ricky Jones said, like, the best place for Confederate statues is the bottom of the Ohio River. You know, that's a stance you can take. And I think that this is absolutely something that's along the lines of going to the middle.
Yes.
And something that can please everybody.
I think so, too. And so we're really happy for all the advocates that have worked really hard to make this happen, especially DeBron Thomas and Russell Allen. They founded Take Back Cheapside and really got this movement going and worked really hard for 2 years to make this happen. So congratulations to all those people. We're really happy for them. And I think this is a good resolution.
Yeah, me too. There was a nice video of those two guys. Maybe it's WKYT or something. I'm not quite sure who did it, but there was a great video of them after it was coming down where they were clearly very emotional. Clearly means a lot to these people. And I mean, absolutely, moving Confederates off of the slave auction site
makes sense is
something that shouldn't be nearly this controversial. So we're glad that this has occurred. I think that we can say that pretty forthrightly. All right. Well, good for Lexington. Good for DeBron and Russell. Good for Take Back Cheapside. Really glad that this resolution has been found. Hopefully it stands. All right, Jasmine, let's talk a little bit about pensions. You titled yours Took Back Cheapside, a great title. My title is The Pension Bill is Still Not Out, But There Is a Framework. Do you like that?
Yeah, it gets to the point.
So, Jasmine, on October the 18th, which is the day after we recorded our last podcast with Kelly Flood, you should go back and listen to that if you haven't. It was a great conversation.
It was great.
On October the 18th, the governor, Speaker of the House, Jeff Hoover, and Senate President Robert Stivers, they released their pension plan, which is entitled Keeping the Promise.
I like your segment title better than the pension plan title.
So, this... What did I call it? The pension bill is still not out, okay? But the pension plan, Keeping the Promise, is not a bill. It's a framework that lays out what they want to do in very broad stretches. Jasmine, there are 10 bullet points, and I was not joking when I said I copied and pasted them into the show notes. The first bullet point, keeping the promise will save Kentucky's pension systems and meet the legal and moral obligations owed to current retired teachers and public servants. No details really included there about how they go about doing that, but a nice bullet point. I mean, I think that any plan should do that, but...
That sounds like the abstract or the objective more than like one of the bullet points to me, but...
I mean, not even the abstract. I feel like it feels more like when you're going to start a paper, you're like, what's the subject of this going to be?
Like the thesis.
Before you even come to a plan, that's what you want to do. So the second bullet point does say something they're going to do. It requires the full payment of the ARC, the actuarially required contribution. That is the amount the actuaries say that the state needs to fund in order to maintain the size and increase the size of the pension, the meet our obligation. So every year there's an ARC. It requires a full payment of the ARC every year. And in addition to that, it creates a new funding formula that mandates hundreds of millions more into every retirement plan, making them healthier and solvent sooner. So it sounds like they're going to increase the amount that we're giving to the pensions. So that is something they say they're going to do. Okay, so now we're getting into the meat of this thing. The third bullet point, for those still working, no increase to the full retirement age and current defined benefits remain in place until employer reaches the promised level of unreduced pension benefits. So Jasmine, that is a little obtuse, don't you think?
Yes.
Okay, so what it basically is saying is, you know, we aren't going to increase the retirement age for people who are currently working. If we said you could retire after 27 years of service or whatever it was, like 15 years of service for people in hazardous jobs, I'm not sure if that number is right, but whatever amount of years we said you had to work to get your pension, that's not going to change. And your current defined benefits remain in place until the promised level of unreduced pension benefits. So that's saying, like, you will get your defined benefit pension at that point. But what is left unsaid in this bullet point is the way that it works right now is if you're a teacher, I believe the number is 27 years. If you teach for 27 years, you get the full pension. And then if you continue to teach additional years, you get more pension. You get I think it's like the five top years, and you continue to increase your benefit for more and more years. But what this is saying is that actually will stop. Once you hit the full amount of time, the full unreduced pension benefit, you stop accruing your pension. And what goes into it is what is going to come in a bullet point in the future. So no changes to benefits, sort of.
And those are only people currently working. That's not new workers,
for those
obviously.
Currently working. Yes, absolutely. Good point. So the next thing, for those retired currently, no clawbacks or reductions to pension checks and healthcare benefits are protected. So you talked about the PFC report several weeks ago, which said that, you know, one way that you could really take a bite out of this pension obligation is to claw back some, or there was a rollback. Yeah, roll back the COLAs, many of which were paid out in the 90s to teachers after there was a massive increase in funding for education. There was, you know, a lot of money that was paid out that was not necessarily, it wasn't spelled out in contracts when they were originally signed. They were just given to teachers and to workers just because, you know, we had some extra money, we decided to give it to our workers. And they said one of the ways you could do that is to claw those back. But that was a little bit of a feint, in my opinion. And now they're like, hey, look, we're actually doing something good. We're not going to claw back this thing. We had this idea that everybody hated, and we're not going to do it. And that's like a whole bullet point. Okay, next bullet point. For future non-hazardous employees and teachers, so anybody not in a hazardous job that works for the state, okay, enrollment in a defined contribution retirement plan that will provide comparable retirement benefits. We've talked a little bit about the difference between defined benefit and defined contribution pension or retirement plans. Defined contribution plans shift the risk to workers. You know, right now we are in this tough shape, but we are essentially saying we're gonna pay teachers a defined benefit. They are going to get a certain amount of money no matter what. The risk is being borne by the state to ensure that we have this amount of money. Defined contribution shifts that risk to individual teachers and individual workers to invest that money in a way that will allow them to have a retirement. And if they pick bad mutual funds, which can happen to anybody, you know, they lose their retirement. It is on their deal. So this is something we've talked about in the past, but suffice it to say, I'm going to count that as a benefit cut. That this is essentially saying for people who are working in non-hazardous jobs and teachers in the future, we're going to cut your benefits. We're moving you from a defined benefit to a defined contribution plan. And even though it says it will provide comparable retirement benefits, I don't believe that's possible. That's just my opinion, but that's how I feel about it.
Just in the way those plans are structured, they are different. And
Yeah.
I don't. Yeah. It may not be possible.
The risks are shifted, and it is essentially taking risk that was being borne by the state and shifting it to the individual workers, which is a benefit cut in my mind. Okay, so that's one of the bullet points that's in there. The next one, for current and future hazardous employees, they will continue in the same system they are now. And so that kind of gives away the game there. They're saying, you know, you're a hazardous employee. You deserve more. You work in a tough job. We're going to let you keep your pension. Teachers and non-hazardous people, no.
Right, and police departments are really hurting right now. Lexington's police department has been doing ads on the radio, like mm-hmm. recruiting and things like that, and extending recruiting deadlines.
Yeah.
And
I heard one for Louisville the other day, too, on the radio. So that this is something that gives away the game a little bit when they say, you know, we're going to provide comparable benefits in a defined contribution plan, but for the jobs that we really need to recruit into and that we really value, we're going to keep your defined benefit pension in place. That does say to me that those defined contributions are being viewed as a cut, even by the governor and the Republicans who are supporting
right.
this plan. Yeah. So the next thing is closes loopholes to ensure payment of death benefits for the families of hazardous employees. That's just a loophole that exists, and that's good. They should close that no matter what. Just know that there was a loophole that existed for hazardous employees where if they die, their spouses didn't necessarily get continued pension payments, which is kind of messed up. They want to close that. I support that regardless.
Right.
Okay, next bullet point. Stops divine benefit plans for all legislators, moving them into the same defined contribution plan as other state employees under the jurisdiction of the KRS board. So I'll talk about this a little bit more in depth in a second, but this is a part of the GOP plan to kind of like blame legislators and say the legislators were being too like opulent with their own piece. And it's I think that this is a little bit of a political move. The state does not spend very much money at all on legislator pensions, even though they are very generous. So, you know, when you get to make the rules, it's not surprising that you do well for yourself. But that is, I think, more in line of fixing a political problem rather than solving a true cost problem that exists. Next thing, no emergency clause. The law will go into effect July 1st, 2018, or law will not go into effect until July 1st, 2018. A little presumptuous, but probably not. The Republicans are in full control, so they're probably going to pass something. They're not going to have an emergency clause, though, so it essentially gives people a little bit of an opt-out.
Yeah. Bit of time.
Yeah, time to decide what to do after they pass something. We saw a lot of bills that passed with an emergency clause at the beginning of the last legislative session that kind of went into effect as soon as they were passed. So there you go. And then the last bullet point, structural changes should improve the Commonwealth's rating with credit agencies, which have downgraded Kentucky's rating, citing unfunded pension burdens. That is true. Moody's, a bond rating agency, has already come out and said that they like, in theory, what the governor's doing, mostly because they said it shows that they're taking it seriously because, like we said, we haven't seen a bill. We don't know actually what's going to happen. But Moody's said, this is a move in the right direction, and we appreciate this. Yeah, that does seem to be something that might be on the horizon based on what the bill actually says. So, Jasmine, those are the 10 bullet points. My big takeaway here, even though there is no actual legislation, is that we're just getting a bunch of promises. We don't really know how this is structured. Some of this sounds good, but they are a little bit giving away the game that they're going to cut benefits for future workers, and they're going to cut benefits for current workers after they've reached maturity in their pension plan already. The way that this is going to work for teachers, this wasn't in the bullet points, but it was in the further presentation that they gave, and this to me is the most eye-popping piece of the pension framework plan, is that new teachers and new employees are going to receive 401k-style plans, those defined contribution plans, but they are not going to receive Social Security. So for me, I have an IRA, and my wife, she has a 401k. So that's going to like, we pay into those and we have a defined contribution type retirement program, but then we're also going to receive Social Security. We pay into the federal Social Security program. And so that's a bit of a defined benefit program that we're going to be part of. So we kind of have a mixed structure where we have a defined benefit piece and a defined contribution piece. Teachers are not going to have any defined benefit situation at all. They are only going to have these 401k style plans, which are completely at the mercy of the mutual funds that they invest in. They will have no fallback whatsoever. So that means they go from having a retirement backed by the inviolable contract, which is something you hear tossed around. That is a state law that says we are going to meet our obligations to you. It's something that's incredibly secure, as can be seen by the fact that even these people that want to really slash the pensions because we don't have enough money, they can't really do do it. They're letting these benefits stand. They go from having this very secure retirement to some mutual funds.
Right.
Which, I mean, that's, to me, not great. That's
so
not great for
those
people.
So who wants to be a public school teacher now?
Right. Absolutely. Who wants to do that? You know, the governor would say, if you're doing it for the money, you shouldn't do it, right? That was what he said in his Facebook
right.
Live video. So, you know, that's the most eye-popping piece. The other thing we talked about, you know, the teachers, once they meet the, what do they call it? The unreduced pension benefit. Once you've reached your full service, you'll get your defined benefit plan. After that, any additional years you work will be paid into a 401k style plan. So you will not continue to accrue your defined benefit contribution. You will then start paying into a 401k and you'll get whatever money in addition. So if you know, a lot of people finish their 27 years of service. If you start when you're 25, you know, you can finish in your mid 50s. You can
right.
get to 27 years. So you have, you know, a good decade of working life left where you could continue. I mean, before you're even eligible for Social Security, which, you know, they never are now. They wouldn't ever be.
Sure.
But before you even hit 65 or 68, you'd have a full decade of life left if you started right away. You would not have any ability to recoup that into a pension. It would go into that defined contribution plan. So naturally, KEA, Kentucky Educators Association, the major teachers union in Kentucky, has come out strong against this proposal. The big changes are for teachers. The JCTA president, Brett McKim, he said that these changes would violate the inviolable contract, which is the state law that says you have to continue to meet the obligations to these teachers. And the KEA president, Stephanie Winkler, said that the plan, quote, changes the rules in the middle of the game, unquote, and would force teachers to retire early. So, Jasmine, if this does indeed pass, there is no doubt that we'll end up in court and the teachers' unions will be the people suing the state over it.
Correct. No question.
Jasmine Lawyer agrees. That's good. That's good. So I'm glad I got that right. So Matt Bevin has been on a bit of a speaking tour about the plan since its announcement. The biggest stop he's made so far is Greater Louisville Incorporated, the Chamber of Commerce for the city of Louisville. He called the critics of the bill chicken littles. He said that the pronouncements of doom and mass retirements are overstated if the bill is passed. He didn't really address any of their real concerns. He didn't say why there wouldn't be a mass retirement. He didn't say why he didn't think people would head to the exits. But really, his whole argument fell back on the idea that he said the state would be financially insolvent if we didn't fix this problem, which, you know, is something that we've heard in a big way. This is something that
everything is the biggest crisis.
Yes,
right.
And creating a crisis and forcing us to solve it, forcing us to cut government in every feasible way to solve the massive problem that we have. And yeah, that's the main political thrust of the GOP around this pension issue. They fully own this plan, right? It was three GOP people up on the stage. It was the governor, the speaker of the house, and the president of the senate, the three most powerful people in the legislative and executive branches, who came out and gave this presentation. And what they said, politically speaking, the political argument they made was to say that previous leaders, which you can interpret to mean the Democratic House, Greg Stumbo's house, and Democratic Governor Steve Beshear, they shirked their duties to the pension system by not funding the full arc, and that the new group, which, you know, you can interpret to be the GOP House, GOP Senate, and Governor Bevin, they have to do the hard work. And they're doing the not fun job of solving this big problem, this big issue that's in front of them, because the governor and the Democratic House just didn't do it in the past. And now they're forced to have to deal with this problem. Interestingly, Jasmine, Robert Stivers, he had a video, a press conference, I guess, and this, I think, happened either today or yesterday, and today's the 25th, it's a Wednesday, and he tried to shift the blame away from the legislature to the boards of the pension system. He said that those boards not asking for statutory changes was the real issue. So I think it's a little telling also that, you know, this political argument that former leaders didn't come together, it's the Democrats' fault that we didn't fund the pensions, when the GOP president of the Senate, who has been in place the entire Beshear administration. Well, not quite the full Beshear administration. David Williams is there, but he was in leadership in the GOP Senate for a long time while Governor Beshear was there. He did not want to blame the legislature and instead wanted to blame the boards of the pension system. So the GOP having a little bit of a trouble getting on the same page because, you know, Robert Stivers didn't sound like he wanted to fall on the sword there. That's at least how I interpret this. But I think you're dead on, Jasmine, when you say that, you know, they're manufacturing a crisis. We had a solution in place. The Governor Beshear's fix to the future problem, it does just as much as this. Because the crux of this is that the skeleton plan that we have in front of us, this proposal, doesn't actually save the state any money in the short term. It only cuts benefits for new hires in the future. So Governor Beshear, he had a pension reform plan that did much the same thing, but actually kept the benefits for many of the teachers and many of the other public servants in place. The plans, the cash hybrid plans, which they are called, they did indeed cut benefits for many of the new hires, but in a way that protected some of the defined benefit aspects of retirement for public employees. This bill just doesn't do anything to address the funding issues actually facing us. It does require us to pay the full arc, which we've done in the past couple of times, but it just forces us to cut deeper other services. And the biggest thing that I would say about this, the most telling piece of this entire proposal, is that tax reform is not addressed even once. There is no addressing of tax reform. So basically we're saying we're going to have to solve this problem. We're going to have to come up with all this more money to fix the issue in front of us by cutting benefits for future employees. We're not going to do anything about the costs that are currently in front of us without doing anything about taxes. And if we make the decision, which I think we should, that we should protect the benefits of the people who are retired now and continue to protect the retirement of the people who are going to be working for us now and are going to get jobs in state government, we should do that by increasing the revenue of the state or by changing around our revenue structure so that we pull in more money that we can use for this, which we're not doing.
Right. I think you said it was telling, and telling is definitely the right word because it tells you who's in charge here.
Yeah.
that's not even part of what they address. And I don't believe the consulting firm that did that proposal, they also did not address tax reform, I don't believe, in a meaningful way, at least. And telling is the correct word for that.
The governor has said that, you know, they will tackle tax reform in the future. That's something he has said they will do. But
it's not a bullet point. And
it's not a
bullet
point.
Bullet points are what matter.
Yeah. And I don't really know if they plan to tackle this pension issue by, you know, these benefit cuts. They want to do it in a special session. I don't know if they would address tax reform in the General Assembly, wait till the next General Assembly is done and we have a budget in place and then go to revenue reform. Because, you know, this will happen probably towards the end of the year, and then we will roll right into the next General Assembly, which we will have to fund the full arc and then fund the rest of the government. And that is going to include making some huge cuts to current services, which are already the recipients of some major cuts already in the past. So there you go. Jasmine, I don't think it's a good plan. No,
we don't like the bullet points.
Yes. I and to be fair, you know, who knows? Maybe they'll actually come out with legislation that says something totally different. who knows? We have yet to see any real legislation.
Right.
I think that this is truly, from a political standpoint, I mean, I've gone through the entire policy breakdown. I hope nobody is mad at me for ranting for too. Are you mad at me for ranting for too long?
I'm not mad at you for ranting.
I appreciate that. From a political standpoint, this is the first real political opportunity that the Democrats have had since losing the election in 2016, which I really do believe that this is something they can capitalize on. My friends out in the state are even talking about this. You know, not the people that I would look at to be like people who would be critical of Governor Bevin are pretty upset mm-hmm. about this. So I think it really provides Democrats a real political opportunity. And you know what, Jasmine? We're going to talk about that next week.
All right.
So, Jasmine, are you ready for some quick hits?
I am.
Okay. First up, Matt Bevin's appeal to keep Kentucky taxpayers for having to pay the attorneys of the folks who sued Kim Davis, it was rejected. So this was something we talked about a couple weeks ago. A judge said that the state of Kentucky and not Rowan County and not Kim Davis had to pay the attorney's fees because Kim Davis was acting as, a employee of the state and then broke the law. And so the state has to pay. Matt Bevin tried to appeal that. And the judge was like, you didn't do any work at all to try to convince me that my argument was wrong. So he rejected that. So we are on the hook for that. And then next, this is relates to our first Took Back Cheapside segment. The plaque on the Jefferson Davis statue in the rotunda of the Kentucky Capitol is being removed. The plaque had called him, Jefferson Davis, a patriot, hero, and statesman. And the reason it was removed was because it had subjective language that not everybody agreed to, which I think that's fair.
That's fair.
That's fair. So
whether it should be there in the first place is another issue, but that's one step, I suppose.
Yes. There are many people who are working towards getting that statue removed. But yeah, you mentioned earlier, the governor said that would be sanitizing our history.
Right.
So, all right, Jasmine, that is it for us this week. How can people get a hold of us?
They can find us on Twitter at @myoldkypod is our Twitter account. We have a Facebook page that you can like, and we post our show notes on Medium and our podcast on the podcasting app of your choice.
All right. Thanks, everybody. And we will see you next week.